Council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Clerk will call the next case.
The court will now call in the interest of F.A. Attala, may it please the court, Mr. Prisnari to argue for the appellant, the father, Ms. Rhonda Bartlett to argue for the appellee, the mother.
Mr. Norris, you may proceed.
Good morning, Justice.
May it please the court? My name is Chris Norris, and I represent the appellant, the father in this case. And due to some of the sensitive issues involved in this case with the termination of possession and access, we both agreed as counsel that we'll refer to the litigants as father, mother. I think there's going to be a reference to an ex-girlfriend and a child. So there are two separate issues before the court today. The first issue is, did the trial court err in naming a father a possessory conservator while simultaneously terminating and indefinitely denying him all possession and access to his child under Section 153, 191, and 193? The second issue is whether the trial court lacks sufficient factual and legal evidence to deny the father all his possession and access to his child based on the evidence in this case and the indefinite nature of his terminated possession and access. One thing both sides agree on is that the father's right to possession and access of his child in this case has been terminated indefinitely.
But it hasn't been terminated permanently.
It has not, Your Honor. He was named a possessory conservator in this case, but the order specifically terminates all possession and access to the child.
He still has the right to go back to court, though, and ask that be reconsidered?
He always has a right to modification. The issue that's present here on that point is, due to the way that the court rendered the order, it's practically impossible, in my mind, as to how he can ever prove a substantial material change that's in the best interest of the child that would allow him to modify this possession order. In the court's original rendition of this order, Judge Hennigan specifically pointed out, and I'll recite, that these allegations are serious. He went on to state, there's going to have to be a CPS investigation and some more work done on this case. The father is to be named as the possessory conservator of the child. I think this is a situation where the trial court was stuck with basically a highly undeveloped record. We have in this case no evidence of any CPS findings, no evidence of any prosecution or attempted prosecution, no hospital records, even though this child was taken to the hospital on two separate occasions at least, according to the record, that there's any indication that there was any sexual abuse of this child. There was no medical professional at trial who testified to anything, but the testimony that I'm sure the court would have sought was whether there's any indication that this child was ever sexually abused. The police in this case, the Irving Police Department, which did initiate an investigation, agreed to drop the investigation after looking into it and suggested to the Irving District Attorney's Office the charges not be pressed.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who testified to that?
That was the father in the case. He was asked specifically about that, whether or not the Irving Police Department continued with an investigation and whether any charges were pressed. That was the information that he was told by the police department, and there was no objection to that that response. So what the trial court was left with was basically a highly undeveloped record for a case of denying all possession and access.
So haven't you kind of right there answered your own question? I mean, you started this by saying that you can't imagine any way that the father could come back and present evidence to prove that he should regain his possession rights. Haven't you just told us what the father could do to come back and move the court potentially successfully to regain possession rights?
Well, the issue that the Texas Courts of Appeal and the Texas Supreme Court have pointed out in that is that under Hill versus Hill specifically, whenever that modification or grounds for modification are left up to a third party, and are conditional and contingent upon a third party, such as CPS opening an investigation, the police department. It puts the father in a position where how is he supposed to go back and modify when he's not allowed to use any evidence prior to the rendition of this order as grounds to support his modification?
But there's exceptions to using that evidence prior to that order. If it's a continuing issue and you're trying to modify something, you got to prove why it was done in the first place and what's changed. So you can go back behind that order.
I don't think that he can ask Child Protective Services, for instance, in this case, which the record is frankly unclear on this point, whether they ever initiated an investigation, how it closed out, whether there's any findings.
He could ask for one now, could he not? He could get the medical, he could subpoena, he could get the medical records. He could go to a counselor and bring that counselor to say that he had, you know, undergone tests and that he wasn't a danger to his child. I mean,
but Child Pro- I'm sorry,
that he could do, aren't they?
Well, Child Protective Services would have no incentive to reopen a case that they've already closed or where there's no investigation and where there's going to be no evidence that he's going to present to them, obviously, that the child is in danger. Child Protective Services typically opens up a case under two different scenarios, one in which there's an emergency situation in which a child is placed in danger or where they've received evidence that there's ongoing, continuing danger to the child.
But there's no... Okay, so Judge Hennigan said what he said about CPS, but that doesn't preclude you from filing a motion with supporting and having supporting evidence for modification, even if you don't have CPS.
And it takes me, well, and I think we may differ on that point in terms of what I believe Child Protective Services or the police department would do whenever there's no reason to do any further investigation. The court already considered those points.
Right. Let's say you're right about that. That still doesn't preclude your client from coming back to Judge Hennigan and asking to modify.
He can. I agree, and as I stated to Justice Kerr as well, I agree that he still has an opportunity to go back and ask the court to modify. The question is whether, in my mind and in my client's mind, is whether or not he could ever produce any evidence of a substantial material change from this order based on the type of things that he would need to show that he's somehow not a danger to this child. And in addition to that, I think one of the most difficult parts of this case is the record that this original decision was based on, terminating his possession and access. The El Paso Court of Appeals just recently did a review of all cases in which a parent's possession and access was actually terminated or denied completely. And in that review, going back over 100 years, it only found one case in which a trial court's complete denial of access was affirmed. In that case, the record was replete with evidence of family violence, a lengthy history of physical abuse in that case. In this particular case, we have basically three pieces of evidence in which anyone could even attempt to draw some sort of inference that there was some sort of history and pattern of sexual abuse in this case. The lead point is that a four or five-year-old child at the time was playing with her father in front of his ex-girlfriend and was playing and bouncing up and down on him and bounced onto his face, and he laughed about that. The second piece of evidence that was introduced at trial was that he had photos on his phone, which he testified were part of his evidence in his own petition to modify. He was attempting to become the primary conservator in that case. There were pictures on his phone of the child's vagina showing redness. His contention at trial, and he ended up dropping his petition for modification when faced with all these other charges, was that the mother had not kept good hygiene with the child, was not bathing the child would come back to him without the clothes being laundered, and it was leading to redness in her vagina, or in her her private region. And then the third possible... One second. And then the third possible piece of evidence was that the ex-girlfriend reported that she thought that the child's vagina was showing redness, and the father took the child to the hospital at that time and had the child evaluated. Those are the only three pieces of evidence in this case that could even possibly support an inference of sexual abuse.
Do you have any sort of claim that the trial court didn't allow the father to fully develop the evidence that he might have put on to refute those things?
Well, I do believe that certainly it's a case where, and I wasn't trial counsel in the underlying case, I certainly would have hoped that there would be a more complete development of the record. There were questions that the court had asked about, for instance, was there a CPS investigation? What happened with this police department? And, you know, the question naturally, I think, that anyone would ask in looking through this record is, why wasn't there somebody there from the police department who could testify and actually guide the court to some degree? I think it put the court in a very difficult position. As the court stated in its own rendition, it was faced with very serious allegations. And I agree, those are very serious allegations, obviously. We're talking about allegations of sexual abuse. The issue for our client is that you see at the end of the day, the record simply doesn't support those serious allegations. There wasn't evidence of serious harm being perpetrated on this child, the type of evidence that you would typically have in a termination-type proceeding. I believe it leaves our client in a position, leaves this father in a position where now he is a possessory conservator, but he only has the very most basic of rights to his child. He has no rights to access, obviously has no rights to possession, but he doesn't even have any rights to access. He has no right to confront the child, to see the child if she's involved in extracurricular activities at the school, anything of that nature. And it puts him in a position where he's going to have to attempt to, I guess, manufacture new evidence, which is a position that I don't believe he should be placed in, when the code specifically allows for, under 153-193, for less restrictive manners to be placed, or less restrictive measures to be placed on the father, such as supervised visitation. The Texas case law is replete with instances of severe physical abuse, severe sexual abuse, and where a parent is still, even in the face of that type of evidence, still allowed at least a two-hour supervised window with their child once a month. In this case, the father was completely denied all possession and access.
You make reference to 153-191 and 153-193, but you have not made reference to 153.004. Isn't that really a very specific provision of the family code that deals with these types of situations?
Yes, 153.04 does deal with instances of physical abuse and sexual abuse. Again, our position is that the record that was developed in this case does not support a record that would justify implication of 153.004 in this case. There's an entire litany of different statutes that are listed under the penal code under 153.004 involving physical abuse and sexual abuse. I don't see any of those particular penal codes that are implicated by the evidence that was presented at the trial in this case. Instead, we're left with a record that basically amounts to an ex-girlfriend's speculation about two separate things. One, photos of the girl, of the daughter on the father's phone, and the second being redness in her private area. And then her interpretation of what even she, in her own record testimony, testified was playful bouncing on her father. It was not as, and she was asked specifically, did he initiate this contact? Was this something, you know, of a sexual nature? That was not her interpretation, but she thought it was inappropriate play.
Did trial counsel ask Judge Hennigan for supervised visitation?
I believe I don't believe so. I don't believe there was a discussion of what the measures should be. The judge ended up rendering his order, which I read part of earlier, that was ultimately his conclusion. I know that issue was presented when there was a motion to sign that was raised regarding the order, but the judge again said that his feeling was that he was going to order no visitation at all.
Was there a dispute as to whether the cell phone photographs showed redness in the private area?
There was some discussion of it. It's in two separate portions of the record. The father testified that he had two photos of his daughter on his cell phone. The girlfriend testified, I believe, that she saw 20 photos. It's almost more of an inference than anything. The inference is that it was related to redness of the of her vagina.
Girlfriend didn't say that.
The girlfriend, I believe, well, I don't remember her directly or expressly stating that.
Well, the ex-girlfriend was really focusing on the private area more than any redness, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
As far as the speculation goes, my reading of what you folks filed was that this youngster was basically naked, and it's not bouncing on a sofa, it's having her private area over his face, was my understanding. Am I incorrect?
And I apologize, I see my time is up. May I respond?
I asked you.
Yeah. I just want to pull up that portion of the record very quickly. This is from the reporter's record 46. The ex-girlfriend was asked the question, tell the court what happened after the first incident. The answer, on the first occasion, the little girl was playing, and he was laying on the sofa face up, and she got up there, and she was bouncing, and she was playing and bouncing on top of him, and then she sat down on his face with her vagina on his face. And what did he do is the next question. The response was nothing. He was laughing. He thought it was funny. That was the evidence that the court was presented with.
That didn't sound like speculation to me.
Oh, I think that
does not have any clothes on. The girl is sitting on his face. That sounds like a criminal offense to me that would be inexcusable.
And Your Honor, well, I don't believe there was evidence that she wasn't clothed at the time. But what her testimony was on two separate portions of what I just read is that she believed that the child was playing and bouncing on him, that this is not something of a sexual nature. For me, myself, I mean, I have a 6- and 7-year-old child, and, you know, routinely when you're roughhousing and playing, I think that's one thing. I think that's one thing that she was seeing with this child. She herself characterized it as playing, not as something that was of a sexual nature.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Bartlett.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, the first matter that the appellee would like to raise just briefly is the inadequacy of the appellant's brief. As the appellee set forth in her brief, the TRAP 38.1I requires that statements of fact be supported by direct references to the record that are precise in locating the fact asserted, and that the appellee and the court shouldn't have to search through vague and broad references to the record or the record in its entirety to locate what is being referenced by the appellant. And, pardon me, if record references are not made or are inaccurate, misstated, or misleading, then the brief supposedly fails. And in this instance, the appellant consistently throughout the brief took me a while to catch on, but was referencing the clerk's record, that's what he was citing to, but when you would go to the clerk's record to find what he was talking about, it wasn't in there, and so started looking at the pages in the reporter's record, and it appeared, at least, that that's what he was trying to cite to. And so this became an undertaking of, okay, I'm checking the clerk's record, there's nothing there, now I have to go and check the reporter's record, and I've got either a citation to an entire page or a span of pages where I need to sift through and figure out exactly what testimony he's trying to pinpoint to support his position. I think in addition to that, the appellant did not cite to all of the necessary legal authority that applies to the case. For instance, the majority of the appellant's position is based on 153.191 and 153.193. There are at least some courts that have extended the the idea that a parental presumption only applies in an original SAPSR to the 153-191, which is the presumption that a parent will be appointed as a possessory conservator. So there was kind of a question, and I really didn't find a definitive answer in the case law as to how the courts are proceeding on that issue. But at least with regard to joint managing conservators, the parental presumption goes away when you move on to a modification. There is no more parental presumption, and everybody's sort of on equal footing. So there was no discussion in the appellant's brief about any conflict or potential conflict between 153.191 and, as you mentioned, the 153.004, which is much more specific with regard to the issue that was before the trial court, which was namely allegations of sexual abuse. And I think that because the appellant failed to acknowledge and address those areas of the law that specifically applied to the case, then the brief fails on that point as well. With regard to the case law that the appellant relied on, most of it predates the current version of the family code. In particular, the Walters case, the Roost case, those cases that were in the 90s when the trial orders were rendered, were decided before some of these sections of 153.004 were even enacted, and they were under prior versions of 153.191 and 153.193. So, and there were some pretty important distinctions in there with regard to the court's analysis, assuming that 153.191 does apply to this case and that it's not a parental presumption that's not a part of a modification proceeding. The earlier way the law was written, the court had to make two determinations in order to deny a person the appointment as a possessory conservator. They had to find first that possession and access was not in the child's best interest, and second, that possession and access would endanger the child. That's not how it reads now. It is first, the court, in order to deny appointment as possessory conservator, has to find that the appointment as possessory conservator is not in the child's best interest. And then the second part of the equation is that the possession or access would endanger the child.
So what do you think that father could do now as a practical matter?
I think the father could do what most people do in the case of a court order, which, as Justice Gabriel pointed out, seek modification under the family code when there's a substantial material and substantial change of circumstances. The cases that the appellant relies on to stand for the proposition that the court has to lay out some path in the order for a modification or for the parent to regain or gain possession and access had to do with cases where possession and access weren't totally denied. They were limited, restricted, or conditioned on the occurrence of something. And what the court, particularly in Hale versus Hale, made clear was that it's if the trial court undertakes to set conditions and limitations and restrictions, then it must be specific such that the order is enforceable by contempt and that everyone knows what they're supposed to do in order for visitation or whatever to resume. In this case, there's no lack of clarity in this order. It's definitely enforceable by contempt. He's not allowed possession or access, so there's no ambiguity in the order. She can go down if he tries to take possession, and she can enforce the order by contempt. If she, on the other side, refuses to give him information about the child's education or significant information about the child's health, which he has the right to under this court order, he can enforce that by contempt. He can go down to the court and say, hey, she's not telling me how the child is doing in school. She didn't tell me that the child had a major surgery or whatever. He still has the right to that information. So I think that the child was 4 years old when this happened. I think there are many times, most court orders just don't set that out. They might tell the family that they have to mediate first, but just like happens with most people, if there's a significant change, for instance, there have been cases that have held that just the aging of the child entering school, those things are sometimes enough to get you in on a modification. The marriage of one of the parents is sometimes enough to get you in on a modification. You can't predict every, you know, instance where a person would have grounds to get their foot in the door on a modification, and then it's up to the court. I mean, for instance, maybe he goes and gets therapy for pedophilia or for abusive behavior. Maybe he goes and gets therapy, and then he comes in with his therapist and says, my therapist says I don't have a problem now or anymore, and he can get in on a modification with that change. I mean, again, I could speculate on and on about possibilities for him to get in on a modification. The mother might, she might modify. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities. And then one thing, I do want to point out, I'm sure the court's aware, there was no request for findings of fact or conclusions of law. So implied findings should be addressed by the court. And I think that the court did specifically find that sexual abuse had occurred. And I know that the appellant has taken the position that just the appointment of a parent as a possessory conservator means that the court must have found that possession or access would not endanger the child. And I think that's still a holdover from the way the law used to read, where it would negate it under the old version of the law. So there has to be a reason that the legislature made that change. And to continue to interpret that particular statute, 153.191, the way it was before it was changed, doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would the legislature, they're busy people, they wouldn't have gone and made this specific change if there weren't a reason for it. There's also, with 153.193, that says you should do the least that you can to protect the child. Well, in that case, I think there was specifically, and I put this in the response brief, the Walters court specifically said, well, the legislature could have said A, B, C, or D. Well, that's what they did when they then enacted the 153.004D-1 and E. They specifically said, if a court finds that sexual abuse occurred during the 2 years before or during the pendency of the lawsuit, and there's no dispute that the allegation of this was during the pendency of the lawsuit, then we go beyond the discretion of the trial court. Trial court can't give access unless it makes other affirmative findings. And it starts to get like a tree and reading stereo instructions, of course, but the court has to consider the commission, the evidence of sexual abuse when it's deciding whether to deny, limit, or restrict possession. So right there under 153.004C expressly says a possessory conservator can be denied possession. Court just has to consider sexual abuse. If the court finds there was sexual abuse, it moves on to D, 004D, and has to decide whether that sexual abuse, when it occurred, that's one factor. And then once it determines that it did, it makes another determination. Is there a way the court could craft an order that would protect the child? And that's under D1. And these are things that the appellant didn't raise in his brief. So
really, D1 deals with family violence.
Well, family violence was, the definition of family violence was expanded, though, I think it was 2013, to specifically include sexual abuse as part of, it is family violence for purposes.
Okay.
Correct. So you can call it family violence. It includes sexual abuse. And I think the legislature was very pointed and clear that this is an extreme case. If there was sexual abuse, that is extreme enough to where we're not only going to say, hey, court, you got to think about this. We're going to say, court, you can't give access unless you make other findings. And there are no, those other findings were not made. So the court didn't abuse its discretion in following the law. With regard to appellant's counsel's statement about the Irving PD having agreed to drop the charges and not refer it to the DA, that is not in the record. There was discussion of that during opening of counsel in the trial record, but that's not evidence. That's just argument of counsel. The question was asked of the appellant, the father, at trial, whether he knew what was going on with the case. As far as you know, as what is your understanding, is the way the question was posed. And he said, as far as I know, they didn't do anything else with it. So there's nothing in the record about what the Irving PD did or didn't do. We know they were called, we know they were contacted, but we don't know what happened. With regard to CPS, there is in the record a safety plan that CPS implemented during the pendency of this case, where the father was denied visitation during the pendency of the case. So that much is in there, but I think it's pretty well known that if CPS has a case going and a court case comes up, CPS will defer to the trial court at that point to protect the interest of the child. So I also think that the appellant could go to CPS and say, hey, investigate this. I don't think there's any reason they could do that. There was no evidence in the record as to how the CPS ended or whether CPS ended its investigation. It was simply deferred to the trial court. Trial court entered an order which CPS would look at and say, child is protected. We're not needed here anymore. I also think there was a little bit of discussion about whether the girlfriend said the child was playing. Part of this is that the girlfriend was testifying through the use of an interpreter, so some of this, you know, the trial judge was there and he was able to, you know, observe the parties and the witnesses and everything, and it may lose, I guess, something in translation in the page, but she did say early on in her testimony that, what did you observe? And she said the child, to play, would lift up her skirt and that she would sit on the appellant's, her father's, face. She then went and talked about that specific instance in April where they pinned her down on the specific instance. And so she did say the child was playing, bouncing on her father, and sat on his face. But in light of her testimony that the child never had panties on and that this, to her, seemed like inappropriate play. I mean, there's all kinds of grooming, and I see that my time is up, so... If there are no other questions, then I'll. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I please court? I'll be brief, but I want to address a couple of points that were raised by appellee's counsel. One is that the issue that's raised with the appellate cases in which we've seen a near denial or near termination of possession access that's conditioned on someone else's opinion, such as a therapist opinion or something of that nature, the court's concern in every single one of those cases is that if it's not specific enough, it basically results in a termination of possession and access, and that's what the court fears ultimately in these cases. Because 153.193, I do believe, is guiding in this case, that if there is a less restrictive means that can be employed, that measure should be employed. I do understand that there's this testimony from the ex-girlfriend, which can be characterized, I think, in a number of different ways, but I do want to point out that there was a police investigation in this case. That's been conceded on both sides, that there was some form of police investigation. There's no evidence in the record that any charges were filed. The father in this case was asked specifically in the record, and it's on the record site, is on the reporter's record page 14 and 15, whether or not an investigation that continued, and he said the charges have been dropped. And he's never been informed by the Dallas Police Department, who's asked this as well, whether they plan to file any charges. And his understanding was no. There's no evidence in the record of that. There's no evidence in this record either of any child psychologist, anyone who's saying that they see things like Appellee's counsel was trying to get into about claiming that there's grooming or that there's some sort of sexual misconduct or that the father is a sexual deviant in this case.
So how do you get around 153.004 C and D, which under D, it only requires proof by preponderance of the evidence that there's been family violence within 2 years prior to the lawsuit, which then mandates that the court not grant any access, unless there are other findings, and we have no findings, so we have to presume the findings support the trial court's judgment. How do you square that with your position?
I don't believe that 153.004 calls for a mandate of denial of access. What I believe it calls for is either denying, limiting, or restricting access.
That's what C says, but D says it is a mandate.
Well, in the way that this order was written up, it does not reference that the court made a finding of family violence within the last 2 years. So I don't think it's triggering that same provision of 153.004, nor is there any reference to 153.004 in the final order in this case. I believe it falls, if anything, under a separate section, which, again, my point originally is that I don't believe 153.004 is or should have been triggered in this case because I think the evidence is lacking. What 153.004 provides is a list of specific penal codes in Texas that are employed. Most of those, and I've been through the list of them, most of those involve sexual abuse or sexual misconduct, but there's not one of those.
Contact between a child's vagina and a female child's vagina and a man's mouth would be, and the child's 4 years old, would be aggravated sexual assault.
And I understand, and I understand that if the court takes that position, I do believe the Irving Police Department investigated this matter and did not recommend filing any charges. I think if this was a case where, after interviewing everybody involved and hearing this evidence, they believe that there was some sort of aggravated sexual assault, I absolutely 100% believe that they would have pressed those charges. I think that would have been the evidence that the trial court would have heard. I think instead what we're left with is a highly undeveloped record, a half-day trial in this matter, where we're left with a lot of innuendo allegations, and I get that those allegations are highly serious. I think the issue is a balancing act with 153-193, that is there some less restrictive means that can be employed so that a father's possession and access with his child is not terminated and he's not placed in a tenuous situation of, is there any way that he's ever going to be able to get some sort of modification that allows him to ever have access with this child again? I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Clearly, this is a serious case, and we very much appreciate your heartfelt arguments and your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you are expected.